we feel like we actually have a really strong pathway forward, and or what we like to call a pathway to power, where the people of Louisiana are actually speaking and not just elected officials that are being pushed around by the oil and gas lobby.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was recently in New Orleans, where I got the opportunity to interview a series of Louisiana-based leaders. This episode with Ashley Shelton is the second of those conversations. Ashley came right out of college into local philanthropy with the Baton Rouge Area Foundation and then moved to the efforts to rebuild New Orleans after Katrina. She's currently the executive director of the Power Coalition, which is a 501c3 table that's building statewide infrastructure in Louisiana to shift power back to the people and increase voter participation through civic engagement. The Power Coalition seeks to mobilize its constituencies to push for real voice and power in marginalized communities. Ashley's put herself in a key role in Louisiana politics and is well worth getting to know. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, please listen to Ashley Shelton of the Power Coalition in Louisiana.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Ashley.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. So my name is Ashley Shelton. I'm the executive director of the Power Coalition and have been with the Power Coalition for the last 3 years trying to build power in the state of Louisiana. I come to the Power Coalition via philanthropy. So my background has been mostly in philanthropy. I worked for the Louisiana Disaster Recovery Foundation, recovering the state after Hurricanes Katrina, Rita, Gustav, and Ike. And then before that, worked for the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, which is a community foundation in Baton Rouge, which is the state capital. And so it's interesting. I always tell folks that I do love philanthropy, but what philanthropy taught me was that money's not enough if you want to really be able to create change, and that people are the spark plug to this engine that needs to be able to move change. And so I found myself really thinking about, like, how do we engage and, you know, empower people on the ground to change the systems that aren't working and making our lives not so great.
Did you grow up around here?
I grew up in Baton Rouge. I'm a Baton Rouge girl. I was, to use embarrassingly so, I went to Baton Rouge High, went to LSU, went to work for the Baton Rouge Area Foundation for the first part of my career, and then Katrina hit, and then I've spent the rest of my career here in New Orleans trying to rebuild.
Were there people here that you knew? What pulled you here when that disaster struck?
What brought me here was that I had a unique set of skills. I knew a lot of different nonprofit organizations around the state. The entirety of the infrastructure here had been kind of upset and was all over the state and in other states. And so because I was here and unimpacted in the, you know, in the literal sense, like my home was still intact, I could get in my car and I could get around. And I did a whole little series called Notes from the Field, you know, was able to evaluate nonprofits, was able to help support nonprofit leaders that were both impacted and rebuilding in the immediate relief phase of the recovery process. It was just trying to support them because I could. You know, I wasn't dealing with all of the other things that my home wasn't damaged or.
Well, what did you see when you came here right after? What was the world like in New Orleans? I know it's famous and well covered, but remind me.
It was stark. It was stark. I mean, first of all, there were only a few of us that were even allowed to get access to the city and to get back into the city those weeks and months that kind of immediately following the storms. I mean, it was pretty stark. I mean, lots of devastation.
Was the water still high? Was it?
So the first few weeks, the water was high, and you only could get around by boat in certain parts of the city. I was in Baton Rouge for a good part of the relief phase, just trying to coordinate airlifts out of, you know, Charity Hospital and trying to coordinate different efforts to support recovery for different folks that were impacted and had health problems that required them to get out and be one of the first line of folks that needed support and help. And so it was a really stark time. I think we didn't have a lot of answers. Everybody's scrambling, people all over the place. And so when you think about like the people that make movement work, whether that be at the time ACORN or PICO or IF, our organizing groups and base building groups, they were displaced as well and impacted and all over the state as well as in other parts of the country. And so it was tough, but it is the thing that I tell people all the time, if you love New Orleans, it'll love you back. And that is true in times of disaster and otherwise. And so much leadership, so many folks that just went out of their way. One of my favorite memories is a letter that we received at the Louisiana Disaster Recovery Foundation from an elderly woman who went without her meds so that she could make a donation to support recovery efforts following the storm.
Is that wise?
I don't know if it's wise, but that's how much it touched.
How much people were pitching in.
Yeah, were pitching in. Like she felt like that she needed to do something.
What do you think you learned about leadership from that experience?
I learned a lot about leadership in that experience. I mean, one, that people will stretch themselves and they will do the impossible to try to hold a community together and make it better and help rebuild. And so I have seen the beautiful side of leadership and folks stepping up and doing what needed to be done. I also learned a few things. You know, I was a little naive at the time, right? You know, like that also the lack of leadership or the lack of doing something.
Or the consequences of poor leaders or lack
Absolutely.
Of leaders.
Yes. Yes, exactly. They're powerful. I used to just think that there was this sense that they didn't know better or couldn't do better. But I also kind of in reflection, you know, almost 15 years later, it's a strategy. It's not that some of them may not have known what to do or how to lead in those circumstances. But there were a few bad characters that I felt like it was a strategy to hold the status quo and to kind of just do just enough to kind of allow some folks to move in and take leadership in other ways, right? And so in the midst of all the folks that were displaced, I'll never forget the first planning process. There were all these different planning processes. The very first one, people in New Orleans got the first glimpse of these maps where their homes were green space, churches, homes, neighborhoods. And folks responded very viscerally to that to say like, oh, wait a minute, right? Like we just didn't go through the worst, most devastating climate event in the U.S. at the time to have you just completely take our communities away, our homes, the fabric of our communities.
Was there a compensation to them for that land or how did that sort out? It sounds pretty severe to be flooded and then lose
right.
your land.
So, right, and to be yeah. a green space, right? Yeah. And so, well, here's what I love about New Orleans, right? It has such a movement spirit. And so people immediately started to organize, and we worked with ACORN and the Jeremiah Group, which was at the time IAF affiliated, as well as PICO, to really organize people and say, like, unless we push back against this, this is going to stand. And so we went through a couple of iterations of different commissions, the Bring New Orleans Back Commission and others, and finally was able to secure what they then called the United New Orleans Plan. And the United New Orleans Plan was over the course of 9 months or, you know, maybe even a year, where they were charrettes and design sessions where people were basically, we forced the leaders that be to really create space for communities to rebuild in ways that included their voice, that supported the kinds of amenities and things that they wanted in community, and most importantly, protected their land. I think that there is a real conversation about some of the places that consistently receive water, and I think people are thinking about the ways that we can mitigate some of those things. But we were able to stop through organizing this idea that New Orleans was going to become the smaller footprint, kind of Disneyland, is what a lot of folks kind of thought about. Like, you've cleaned all the people out, and then you're going to have this, like, really pristine destination, you know, instead of the reason people come to New Orleans anyway, which is the people and the food and the culture.
And maybe a little more gritty.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So ever since you mentioned you came out of philanthropy, I've been wondering, how did you get into philanthropy?
I have a communications background, mass comm major and graduate. And
where at?
At Louisiana State University. And they said the local community foundation was looking for someone that could do some program evaluation and writing and engage in community. And so through some funny connections, I was able to interview for the job and receive it. And so it was straight out of college. I went into the community foundation.
And how long were you there?
7 years.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, what's really interesting is that I left, my kids were young, and so I started doing more organizational development consulting with different nonprofits around the Southeast. And, you know, I had kind of thought I was done with philanthropy. And then Katrina happened, and Lynetta Gilbert, who at the time was at the Ford Foundation, she's like, I'm calling you out of retirement. I was like, I'm like 27. I'm not. I was like, I was
how
not in retirement.
I have
three.
How do they inform your, how you look at the world?
They center for me the reality that everything I love is in this place at the current moment. And as my children grow and mature, I want them to have an opportunity to want to live here, right? And to work here and to build a family here. And I feel like we're getting closer to that. But at the time, especially after the storms, there was just so much going on that I felt like my kids won't stay here, you know, and I'll be on an airplane for every holiday. And and I don't want to be on an airplane every holiday forever, you know.
How do you think New Orleans is doing now? I was here 20 years ago and I'm here again for the first time, really. Mm-hmm. And I still see sidewalks that aren't refreshed. I see some signs that it hasn't come all the way back, or that isn't super wealthy as a city compared to some others that have had a lot of investment.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it?
We're in an interesting place. I think that there is a lot of that has come back, and people, you know, like unless you kind of get deep into the city, you wouldn't be able to kind of see the cracked sidewalks and some of the other things. And the city has done has been really intentional about making sure that depending on where you are in the city, that you have a wonderful, very hospitable experience. I think what is unfortunate and what we're still battling is the gentrification of New Orleans that is happening kind of leaps and bounds. We have a huge kind of Airbnb short-term rental thing that's happening in the city right now that we are consistently fighting back against in a couple of different campaigns with some of our partners.
What is that doing?
It makes living in the city just inaccessible to people that actually live here.
It's raising rents, basically. Is that sort of what it's doing?
One, the housing stock isn't available to rent or lease, right? Mm-hmm. So for the fabric of a neighborhood where you've got most folks that are living there, homeowners and or long-term leasers, you know, you have a neighborhood, right? And and people that you know and consistently engage with. Well, if two or three of the houses on your street are Airbnb, you've got a constant flux of folks kind of coming in and out of the neighborhood.
It's not zoned against that, or?
So we did fight for some limitations and then a special tax that the short-term rentals pay into to increase and support more affordable housing. You know, there's been some challenges around like where are those dollars and are we most efficiently using those dollars to actually increase affordable housing? We have a great partner in the Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance that leads that work, and we certainly support them in trying to make sure that those dollars make a difference for real people. But at the moment, those short-term rentals also create that there's a feeling here in the city that they're waiting for the bubble to burst and all this money and all the new people to come in, and they're going to be sitting on these properties that are, you know,
valuable.
Yeah, more valuable and a greater opportunity for them to make more money. And that's great, but it isn't great for the people that actually live here and can't access affordable housing in the city where they work and live. And so I think that's, you know, the issue that we've been seeing with the short-term rentals and how it's impacting people and certainly pushing people further and further out of the city and certainly further away from any ability to be able to afford to live in the communities that they love.
Did you start Power Coalition yourself? Mm-hmm. So what are the other highlights on your road to doing that?
I had the opportunity to work for the Louisiana Disaster Recovery Foundation, which was one of the three entities created by the governor of Louisiana at the time to respond. And so we had the foundation, which was the philanthropic arm. There was the Louisiana Recovery Authority, which was the policy arm. And then the Louisiana Family Recovery Corps, which kind of did all the social service aspects. And so in the midst of trying to recover the state, we also got the Bush, Clinton, Katrina funds that came into the foundation. You know, we knew that no matter how much money we had, it would be far dwarfed by the federal dollars. And so we really spent a lot of time focusing on using those dollars to build out more policy infrastructure in the state and to ensure that the nonprofit sector could fight well for the things that they knew they needed and certainly the things that they saw happening in community that needed support. And so, you know, it was really eye-opening for me to be able to fight those fights and to work in community in those ways and build policy and organizing infrastructure in a way that they could live together and weren't at odds with each other, as well as have a few wins, right? I mean, I think that even though we had $50 million and we did a lot of work around affordable housing, of course, and rebuilding homes, we did a lot of small business work as well to help small entrepreneurs that we knew would be those kind of first employers back on the block and trying to get people employed, getting those businesses back up. And then the third piece of our stool was really building policy infrastructure so that we could really fight the real fight, which was to ensure that of all the billions of dollars that were going to actually flow through our city, that some of them actually met the ground and made a difference. I tell folks, you know, it's some of the work that I'm the proudest of in my career. It is also really frustrating to know that, like, even though we worked so hard and we put so many hours in recovering the state of Louisiana, I still couldn't tell you where the number's way more than $50 billion. But I mean, you know, the number that people talk the most about is kind of like that initial $50 billion worth of reinvestment and redevelopment dollars that came into the state through FEMA and other federal channels. Gosh, where did it go? You know, we see the
sewage. Where did it mostly go?
I mean, it went to a lot of places. Some you can see, some you can't. But I think that there's
like
still
just to people, to businesses, to
grifters. The Louisiana Recovery Authority had any number of different programs that they had the Road Home program, which was a housing program to be able to give dollars back to homeowners that were impacted by the storm. There were several programs around small businesses, piggyback programs, Lot Next Door.
And all that does contribute to the economy and sort of gets people revving back up a little bit.
No, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think, and you know, and we spent a lot of time ensuring that those processes were as equitable as they could be. Mm-hmm. Some fights we won, some we didn't. One of the things that I think I'm most proud of was the equity inclusion campaign. And so we did some federal level advocacy and really brought together the Gulf Coast, so Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama to fight for what we needed. Because one, we got less than we should have given the damage because we had a Democratic governor in Mississippi. We had a Republican governor under a Republican president, that things weren't happening the way they should. And then Alabama said nothing even happened. They were fine. And meanwhile, the Gulf Coast in Alabama was just devastated. And so to be able to advocate and then do that thoughtfully and with a plan and a strategy helped us secure the second allocation. Worked with Mary Landrieu in her office to help secure that second allocation for Louisiana that kind of was going to make us whole. And then also, too, helped Mississippi and Alabama also get some of the things that they needed. And typically how in times of disaster, what happens is that they pit us against each other. And the Equity and Inclusion campaign was the first time that advocates from the ground came together and said, no, it's not okay for Louisiana to be hurt, and it's not okay for Mississippi to be hurt, and it's not okay for Alabama. Like, here's what we need. And what strikes me from that time was that when we went up to the Hill, we took 40 to 50 advocates from around the Gulf Coast to Capitol Hill, that we were the first impacted people that they'd ever spoken to. So other than Mary Landrieu and, you know, and Louisiana elected body, they hadn't really talked to people that were impacted by the storms. And so the ability to be able to tell our own story, to bring about any number of different congressional hearings around housing and how resources were being spent, it gave us a real opportunity to tell our own story and to create different levers of accountability, both, you know, at the state and local level here in Louisiana. So
this gives you a pretty kind of inside view of how politics works and how politics impacts people in times of trial like that. What other things did you learn about sort of national politics and how it connects to local politics through that?
Just the sheer fact that the allocation was smaller for Louisiana given the damage, right?
Do you think that was just solely a partisan thing, or was there more effective advocacy coming out of Mississippi? It really felt like they're favoring a state, because it's a Republican state, right?
Yeah,
nowadays,
for sure.
Didn't used to be, but you would think that it would have a lot more to do with the people than who they happen to have most recently elected.
Yeah, so I mean, at the time, it felt very partisan. I mean, I can't say for sure what all the motivations were, but I mean, clearly, given the damage, in comparison,
and who was damaged
seems to.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so, I mean, I think that for us, it was about how do we fight for what we needed to be whole in that process.
When you saw what happened in Puerto Rico recently and how apparently we've turned the other face and we haven't looked and helped in anywhere near like we did here on the mainland, right?
Right.
Does it remind you of that at all? Have you thought about that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think anytime there's a disaster, I think about it. And it's the one thing that I'm uniquely qualified to respond to and to be supportive of. And so when it first happened, I was just thinking, like, how can I help? What can I do? And just because I have a certain kind of disaster recovery philanthropic framework doesn't mean that I have the access, right? And so I was really excited because several funders at the national level, they were able to connect me. And so we were able to share the things that we learned.
And, oh, that's good.
And what was exciting, too, is that we had a former, you know, official from HUD that was at HUD during the Louisiana recovery who could shed some light on any number of different processes and be able to kind of support them in that process. And so just to be able to just give them the lessons learned, I think was really powerful and made me
feel like you're doing something.
Yeah, it made me feel like I was doing something. But then also, too, it was just that moment that you reflect, too, because it is still very triggering. Like, I think that people, oh, that's 15 years ago, whatever. Like, you guys get over it. Like, the city's back. There's nothing to talk about, nothing to see here.
And a lot of lives changed.
Oh, absolutely. And then the one reflection that every single person, because we had a full day and we brought in different panels to address different issues of recovery. And to a person, they said, do not forget about the children. And it just has sat with me since that day. And that was, at this point, over the summer that I think we were able to talk to a delegation from Puerto Rico about the ways in which that they could provide support and what we learned and the things that they should look for. And so even for me, like even in my own kind of reconciliation of all the things that happened and all the things that we were able to do, it is for many people this thought that, like, gosh, we didn't do enough and we should have thought more about the impact on our children, and that here we are 15 years later thinking about like what's happening to our youth and thinking about violence and thinking about all these different things that pop up and the fact that there wasn't enough supports and not enough care given to the amount of trauma that they experienced, even more so than the adults in their lives.
What's the founding story for the Power Coalition?
The Power Coalition came to be because we were just tired of losing. After the storms, we just spent a ton of time at the legislature trying to fix things, right? And so whether it was making it a crime to swindle old people out of, at this point, they were swindling everybody. It wasn't even just older people being taken advantage of, but these contractors that were taking advantage of people that had road home money or received some kind of resources. So we made it a crime, and we built out the Louisiana Housing Trust Fund that provided money for deeply affordable buildings and housing units. And so to be able to create legislative instruments that really supported and supported the rebuilding that was happening and being supported by federal dollars, we wanted to make sure that the state dollars were able to do those same things. And also, too, to continue to hold the federal dollars that were coming in, hold the state and the feds accountable for how and in what ways we were supporting people. And so because we spent so much time in the legislature trying to hold everyone accountable, we were losing more than we were winning. In the beginning, we were winning a lot because there was just so much dysfunction and chaos that we could get a housing trust fund and we could, you know, secure
resources.
People
knew there were real needs and it was really recent and yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so the further you get away,
business as usual.
Yeah, it's business as usual. And those recovery dollars and all the different pools and pockets that they kind of sat in, they become the way you fix everything else, right? Instead of the way you fix the things that those dollars were allocated to fix. At the legislature, it'd be me and Norris Henderson, Ming Nguyen, who runs an organization called Vela. And we'd be walking through the halls of the legislature and we'd be like, well, how'd you do today? And, you know, Norris would be like, didn't win today, couldn't move on some of the voter stuff we wanted to get done today. You know, I'd see Ming and I was like, oh, how are you doing? What'd you get today? Like, were you able to win anything? No. And so it really was born out of this necessity of like, well, if we're going to be doing this and never winning, the competitors.
Maybe you got to change the legislature if you can't talk them into doing the right thing.
Absolutely. And that we needed to shift how we thought about our work, that it wasn't enough for us to just advocate, right? It wasn't enough for us to just be able to define very clearly what the issues were, but to call out the fact that maybe our legislators didn't care, right? Or some of them anyway.
When you're talking about power in this context, what power are you seeking or trying to build?
So we'd seen money, right? We'd seen money in play. We'd worked with many powerful people. You know, the like I said, we had Bush, Clinton, Katrina funds. I mean, both presidents, former presidents, were available and accessible for however we needed to recover the state. We had Native sons that also kind of came back and were trying to be a part of the solution and the recovery. But it still didn't move the needle as much as it felt like it needed to move. And so power for us became about the people. It was just like, so if the money and people with power weren't going to do what was right or couldn't do what was right or didn't know what was right because they weren't talking to people in community, that we were going to bring that to play in a very different way. And that's the missing piece, right? Like that we keep trying to solve problems the old Louisiana way, and that way does not work. And that if we want to really realize system change and move the needle on the systems that are, you know, holding people in these cycles of poverty, we've got to build their voices, and we've got to build their voices to a level that they cannot be ignored. And so I always, tease Norris. He's got a million sayings, but one of them is, I want to be a force to be reckoned with. And we've been able to be that in some ways around engaging and getting voters to say what they want, to articulate what it is that they want, the change they want to see in their community. We've been winning, right? Like in terms of what community wants and what they need and the kind of leadership they want. You know, over the last 3 years, we've seen some significant wins and shifts that we feel really, really proud of.
What are some of them?
We were able to identify that there were 20,000 African-American women in Algiers, which is on the West Bank of New Orleans. They were infrequent voters. And so
infrequent voters, yeah.
Which basically means that they vote for the president but don't vote otherwise.
Yeah.
So we started a seven-touch program. So, you know, it's a couple of door knocks, a couple of phone calls. And by the fifth call, you know, or touch, right, the women in Algiers said, we got this. We just didn't know we had this kind of power. We didn't understand. You have now told us, and so we got this. And so
what did activating these women change?
So a couple of things. So one was in 2015, they had a state races. And so for the first time in 25 years, they actually elected a House rep that representative that looked like them, but more importantly, was accountable to them.
Who's that?
Gary Carter. So he's their House rep now. They were represented by Representative Heitmeyer, who voted with then Governor Jindal 90% of the time, which did not align with the values of those 20,000 women in Algiers.
And that sends a message.
It absolutely sends the message. And then what I love about the women in Algiers is then they follow that up for the local municipal elections, and they unseated their city council person and said, we hadn't talked to you in 4 years. We're going to bring back our former city council person and put her in office because she listened and she did the things that we needed her to do. And so they unseated an African-American woman and elected a white woman, who Christine Palmer, who had been their representative before.
Who was doing a better job.
Yeah, who was doing a better job. And so it is, to me, what I appreciated is that they've articulated what they want, and then they have used their votes to get what they want in terms of leadership, and then the other things that they need in their community. And so, that you know, it's one of my favorite examples, but it is just about what can happen when people come together and use their power to realize the things that they want.
So what is the Power Coalition? Who is it a coalition of?
So the Power Coalition is anchored by about 9 organizations that are all base building groups. When we first got started, we kind of had fits and starts. So we had both advocacy organizations and organizing organizations at the table. And we just couldn't gel. Like we couldn't, you know, like really move forward. And so what we ultimately decided, and, you know, Norris's great wisdom, Norris said, I've got a secret for you. He said, you know, if you want to make this work, base building groups, we are always on the ground and we're always doing the hardest part of the work. And so it creates this fissure around, like, we don't really trust the advocacy groups because when it's time for the photo and the press conference and the...
They're going to take the credit?
Yeah, like they take the credit, or, and not so much that they take the credit, but that like we aren't given our real space, right? Like to appreciate the people part of any kind of action or win. And so that's what we did. We shifted and brought all base building groups to the table. So Voice of the Experience, FELA, Friends and Families of Louisiana's Incarcerated Youth, Greater New Orleans Housing Alliance, the Worker Center for Racial Justice.
And these are groups of what size, would you say, like typically? Like how many people are working there? What sort of budgets?
Some of them are small and scrappy, like Step Up Louisiana. I mean, you know, they've just expanded their staff. It's 3 of them now. But they organize thousands of people across the state of Louisiana.
They're speaking for a lot more than... than they are on their staff.
And now, for sure. I mean, the Power Coalition was just me and my data guy for about a year there.
What is it now?
And now we're up to six people. Mm-hmm. And so we are all kind of like small, scrappy shops. I mean, I think Vote has a bigger team, Voice of the Experienced. But at the end of the day, I mean, we're all kind of relatively medium-sized nonprofit organizations that have been doing base building work for many years.
And when you sum all that work up, what do you think changes in the state?
What's been exciting is that, like, we've been seeing the change, right? Like, I think sometimes in this work, I'm a programmer in terms of, like, in philanthropy, to be a program person and understand how programs are created and funded and evaluated. People always underestimate the planning and the amount of planning that's required and that the, and the value of it, too. And so what I think is really exciting is that, like, we've been winning. And we've been able to show that, like, if we put our work within a shared frame, we can win. For example, legislatively last year, we were able to get our partner FLIC, which is Friends and Families of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children, onto the highest decision-making board for juvenile justice reform in the state. And so now to have a real community voice at a table that has been closed to us for quite some time, that's a point of power. And that commission has the juvenile justice reform, it's got a bunch of letters, but this reform commission has the subpoena power. It has the power to call anyone to testify. It has the, you know, like it has.
And so what is that, what difference has that made for the children that are that you're talking about?
All reform has a story. And in fact, it's an infinity symbol of a story because you're constantly either changing something, and then if you can get something changed, you're trying to enforce it. And so 15 years ago, the state of Louisiana had front page news, reformed our juvenile justice system. All of these amazing partners from around the state that had worked with the state agencies to make this happen. And then we've spent the last 15 years trying to get it enforced. And then because people don't know the history, then folks kind of piecemeal the reform again. Like, so they take pieces of the package and just repackage it and try to fight for those same reforms that we already actually have in law and statute in the state of Louisiana.
They're just not operative.
Yes, exactly. And so what this gives us an opportunity to do is to hold some folks accountable to tell the historic story of, like, how we got here and what needs to happen to actually implement these policy changes. So what it does for children is that it gives us the ability to finally change some of these laws that have created the school-to-prison pipeline that push students of color out of schools and lessen their access to a quality education.
I come from D.C., where we think a lot about national politics and and more about state politics, probably in how it affects national politics. Where do you fit into that bigger game of politics in Louisiana and nationally?
We really have identified the state as our focus, right? I mean, I think that, you know, most of our groups are based in South Louisiana. Because of Katrina, we've got the most strength in South Louisiana because that's where we built the most infrastructure. And it's because it's where we had to build the most infrastructure. What we have successfully done in the last 2 years is really been able to expand our reach statewide and to really start to connect people around the state that are just working for equity and working for change and doing it from a people perspective and with the purpose of empowering folks around the state.
Do you coordinate or do you also help people find money and other resources?
Yeah, no, we do absolutely coordinate, as well as we also re-grant. So we've been blessed to be able to re-grant dollars to our partners around the state to do the work that they're doing so that we really actually have the power to do the things that we want to do. And so what happens when you come out of a disaster paradigm is that you constantly get used to reacting to everything. And so for the first time in 15 years, I feel like we are absolutely proactively positioned to really be able to respond to 2019 statewide elections and to really be able to hold candidates accountable around our agenda and the things that we care about.
What are the big things that you're working on right now leading up to 2019?
What we're working on right now is currently the state of Louisiana preempts municipalities from raising their wage. And for the larger municipalities...
So you can't raise a minimum wage.
Right.
Unless the state government does it.
Exactly.
And so you're held at the federal minimum wage, which is not much.
Right, right. And then what's really interesting, too, is that we're also one of five states that don't even have a minimum wage, right? So the federal wage, of course, prevails, but, like, we don't even have a minimum wage on the books. And so we've been able to have several wins locally in places like New Orleans and Shreveport, New Orleans, for all city-funded contracts. It's now $11 an hour, includes some paid sick leave. Shreveport also, I think, for all their city-funded contracts, pays $10 an hour. So for us, it's about how do we address that? How do we actually expand economic opportunity in the state of Louisiana? The other piece that is, you know, kind of near and dear to our heart is equitable redistricting process. And so this will be the first time Louisiana does redistricting without Shelby in place. We've never submitted maps that have ever passed the Shelby test, if you will. And so for us to be able to try to define that on the front end and to define it for these candidates, because our legislature does redistricting, it's going to be really important to
us. Who controls your legislature right now?
We're considered a red state. I mean, our governor is a Democrat, but both the House and the Senate currently are controlled by Republicans.
So there'll be some compromise between the legislature and the governor.
Somewhat. And so
we'll see what happens after the 2019 election.
Yeah. So we'll see. So I think that's exactly what we're gearing up for, which is to say, like, I don't care what your letter is behind your name. What I do care about is, are you serving the needs of your people? In 2015, we did a statewide survey with Louisiana State University, and 76% of the people of Louisiana agree that we should raise the minimum wage. More than 60% of the people in the state of Louisiana love the idea of local contracting and local hire. And so these concepts that we constantly fight at the legislature about, and the legislature is constantly kind of beating us back and saying, you can't have that, it's problematic. And we want to be able to say, like, something's wrong when we can't get our elected body to, you know, like, to do the work of its people.
Does it seem like there are enough legislators that are vulnerable to challenges to move the legislature your direction substantially?
What's exciting about 2019? For us is that, so Louisiana has term limits. So like every like 12 years or so, you know, like more than a third of the legislature is going to turn over. Mm-hmm. So they're term limited out, which creates lots of opportunity, right? So from pipeline perspective and folks seeking to run, understanding like how and in what ways community is going to hold them accountable. I think, you know, we're excited about that. But then the other piece too is that for those folks that are vulnerable or challenged, we actually have the resources and the time to say, are you going to do the work of community or not? And if you're not, then we're going to make sure the community is fully engaged in a process to make the best decision about who will truly represent their interests. We feel like we actually have a really strong pathway forward or what we like to call a pathway to power, where the people of Louisiana are actually speaking and not just elected officials that are being pushed around by the oil and gas lobby.
When you think about allies for you, so you have your coalition of groups, mm-hmm. but groups that are external to the power coalition, mm-hmm. who else is an important ally in the state?
We work with NAACP, we work with labor, you know, so AFL-CIO and LIUNA and many others, you know, like we work with them as well because we agree, right? I mean, like we're building out this preemption campaign in partnership with those very groups to figure out like how are we going to move the needle. And then with the understanding that we may not get what we want this legislative session, but building a bigger drumbeat as we move into the 2019 statewide elections to let candidates know that this issue isn't going anywhere and... You know, and the people of Louisiana want to know what your answer is. The Power Coalition itself is C3. We are probably going to develop a C4 as we get closer to the 2019 statewide elections. But our partner Vote, which is Voice of the Experienced, also they have a C4, a very effective C4. And so that statewide ballot measure that I mentioned before around unanimous juries, you know, Vote really led that and really built out the unanimous jury coalition that...
Now you need a unanimous jury
to over. Yes, you have to have a yes. So instead of 10 jurors, you have to have all 12 jurors agree to convict.
Which is the norm across the country, right?
Right. Oregon and Louisiana.
Else?
Yeah, Oregon is the only other place that it's happening.
On that?
And they're working on it. Yep. Because once it was, we were the last two and we fixed ours. So now I know that, you know, Norris and others are, you know, supporting them and trying to figure out how they can overturn theirs. But that campaign, what it did was a couple of things, right? We touched over 1 million people in the state of Louisiana. White, black, conservative, progressive. We did it effectively and we did it efficiently. What that campaign also did was allow us to identify leadership around the state that could actually get people into a room, you know, support listening sessions, do all of the different things that are necessary to really engage a community. And so to have those organizers and those folks around the state identified and not something that we had to figure out for this year. I mean, it's been really powerful to have those things in place as well. Kind of more directly to your question, to also then be able to come to our partners and our allies in a way that we haven't before, in the sense to be able to say, like, okay, like we were able to prove what we knew how to do and how to do it at scale statewide, you know, which is really powerful. And so for us, you know, like those allies, whether it be labor or or other service providers. We do a lot of work with the United Way. You know, they have their ALICE report. What it basically means is income constrained, right? It's this idea of what does it actually cost for a family to live in the city of New Orleans? So that as we talk about raising the wage, we've got real data and evidence of what it takes for one person, a single parent with one child, a single parent with three kids, or a family with three kids, or a couple with three kids. So helping people understand what it really takes. We've got a third of our children in the state living in poverty, and that we keep finding ourselves at the bottom of these lists, and that we tease about racing to the bottom with Mississippi, but we won the race, unfortunately.
Race you want to win.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that we have to pay attention to those things. It's important. And I think when I think about 2018 and the things we were able to win, and so whether it's unanimous juries or another huge policy win last year was winning the right for people on probation and parole to vote in the state of Louisiana to re-enfranchise their voting rights. It was passed through the legislature, and it was just this beautiful moment of advocacy and organizing to have a senator say, like Chico, who's one of the staff and organizers for Vote, to say, Chico, I'm here for you, and Chico, I'm voting for this because of you, not because of some cool letter from Drew Brees or,
that's cool.
You know, some great letter from some higher up somewhere, but because of you, because you've been in my office every day reminding me that you have every right except for your right to vote. You lead your choir, you lead Boy Scouts for your grandchild, and you're doing all of these things, driving your wife to go vote, and then not being able to have that right. So for us, it's these wins in a red state that folks never thought were possible.
Surprising.
Yeah, it's surprising, but I think for me it just... But if you know the people,
but people of Louisiana, are working on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you know the people of Louisiana, it feels right, right?
It's not an ungenerous people.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's this chasm between the leaders we elect and our values. And so what we're trying to do is bridge that in a way that I hope nets us a better state and a state that is representative of those values.
How do you look at the national politics in this sort of area? Because there was a sort of surprising reforms coming out of the White House a little bit on the incarceration mm-hmm. problem. Mm-hmm. How did that affect you in your role?
We certainly pay attention and we watch those things. I mean, right now we're gearing up to do census work, and you know, citizenship question is a big issue.
Yeah.
One of our partners, the New Orleans Worker Center, you know, does a ton of work with one of their campaigns.
And that got put on hold by a court, right?
Yeah. I think New York and one other place, California, both have lawsuits, and the Supreme Court just agreed to take it up.
Yeah.
It's all around us. I mean, those criminal justice pieces, I feel like this interesting thing that's happening in the policy advocacy world and organizing, which is sometimes you want to win so bad that you just take the win, right? Whatever that is, whether it's, you know, how small that win may be. What Power Coalition and our partners are about is like, how are we actually moving the needle, right? And making a real change for people. And so it's not enough to check a box and say like, oh, look how great we did this.
There's so much to do.
Right, yeah. Exactly. There's so much to do. And so how are we truly, you know, being accountable to the base of all the different groups that we represent? And how are we doing that in a way that is true and authentic to the people that we talk to every day? And so I think some of the work that Van Jones and the president are doing, I mean, it's been interesting. We've been watching it very closely, but I mean, I think there are those among us that feel like it doesn't go far enough. Are we happy that, you know, the president...
It's better to get something up
there. Exactly. And so from that perspective, sure, but like that it's not enough to say like, okay, we don't need to continue to have the conversation about criminal justice reform in this country, and that let's let this one person out and let's let that one person
so
out.
So what would be your dream if you could really turn this coalition into the powerhouse of the future? How would the state change?
One, I think for there to be true representation, right, of who we are as a people. Well, I always tease that Louisiana is like the last great colony. And, you know, funny enough, when you think about Texas was a republic before they became a state. Louisiana was a colony and then it became a state. So there was no form of government that existed between being a colony and a state. And it shows up in all of these interesting ways. Like New Orleans, we're still governed by Napoleonic Code, one of the only states in the country. You know,
what's an example of how that affects things?
It has a lot to do with property, mm-hmm. but also too, it affects like if you want to be barred in Louisiana, like our law is very different than most places in the state.
And so I got to learn more about that.
Yeah. And so Like I said, we always are unique. What we hope to realize, you know, like through this process is like true government, right? Like that is representative of its people, that puts its people first, right? And so all of the interest of oil and gas, there's so much money that is...
You feel like big money is controlling it to their benefit rather than to the average person. Absolutely. Yeah.
Just like everywhere, right?
To a worse degree, maybe.
Yeah, to a worse degree. And here's what's so sad is that, like, what I think our greatest frustration is that, like, where are they going to, you know, like, they always say, like, we have to give all these tax credits, you know, like Sasol, which is this huge South African conglomerate or whatever. And it's like, so we're going to give them all these tax breaks, but the natural gas and the oil is underneath our state. Where are they going to go? Like, you can go anywhere you want to, but if you want this oil and this gas or whatever it is that you're trying to, you know, kind of pull extract out of the state, extract from the state, right? Like, you have to pay, right? Or you have to provide more jobs. And the whole idea is, like, how do you just balance things in a way that says, like, I'm not anti-business?
That doesn't seem like a very unreasonable aspiration to me.
Right. I was like, I'm not anti-business. We're just, you know, we're just pro-people. And from an infrastructure, environmental, in every other, you know, issue area you can think of, like, we're just not where we need to be. I think that, you know, we worry about climate change more so than anybody
right now.
Exactly. Like, we don't have a choice. And, you know, and every year at the legislature, there's still legislators that tell me we don't have a climate change problem. People have to Clorox their houses out once a year in your district. What are you talking about? You don't have a climate change problem. And so we've got some challenges, but business has been able to have control for a very long time. And the only way we're going to break that down is by doing the work that we're doing. And I am hopeful that, you know, in the dream of dreams, right, like that we can create some balance. We are a very gerrymandered state. And so even though,
you know, we've got... Super hard to win power, even if you have the votes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so even as we fight for reform and change, at the end of the day, I want to realize a state that is actually mapped in a way that is true to the people of this state and not to special interest. And so I think that being able to create that balance and to be that force to be reckoned with and to balance it out, because that's the other thing that we know is that, like, as we make investments in the election process and getting people engaged in that process, there's not a lot of other money at play other than candidate money and oil and gas and other folks that play in those circles. And so to be able to put money on the people side has been, you know, has just been powerful. And it's been a great journey for us. And we've been winning, and we hope to keep winning and keep pushing and helping the people's voices rise to the top. And so for me, the dream is a better state, a state that deserves the title of everything I love is in this place.
And that your kids will want us to keep living here.
Right. So that I'm not on a plane for Thanksgiving. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think that's ultimately for me, like, what we hope to see is just a stronger state that is more representative of its people and a state that is willing and ready to move forward in the ways that we see so many of our Deep South states struggling to do. And thankfully, this governor has done Medicaid expansion and brought us into a much, you know, kind of stronger position in terms of accessing healthcare and other things. He still, you know, to this day, receives all kinds of pushback around the fact that he did it, even though we're one of the poorest states in the country with the least amount of access to healthcare. And so for us, it shouldn't be that it's a political equation about whether or not you do the right thing for the people of this state, but that it is, we're going to do the right thing for the people of this state. And then leave the math to the lobbyists and all those other people about what they're going to do to be able to move the people of Louisiana towards whatever their direction is. But I trust and believe that when we're in community talking to folks, they know what's wrong and what's going on in their communities, and they oftentimes have the solution. And we talk about that all the time. The people closest to the problem are closest to the solution. How do we make sure that those solutions hear the light of day and are actually being implemented in communities across the state of Louisiana? And we see it happening in small ways, whether it be Algiers or most recently the city of Alexandria, which is in the center of the state. They just elected their first African-American mayor, and you know, and they've got a majority African-American city council. And so, you know, just the ways in which people are starting to use their power to try to realize the differences that they want in their community is, you know, it's exciting and it's catching.
That's great. It's been an honor to talk to you today.
Yeah, same here. This is great.
Anything else you want to say?
And one of the things that has been one of our greatest joys in doing this work is helping to break down the realities of how people in our state vote and helping people own the fact that, like, it doesn't take 100 people to change an election, right? Like, we had a House rep that was elected with 3 votes. We had another House rep that was elected with 6 votes. And so being able to break that down and have those conversations all over the state has been so empowering and so invigorating for us. And so, you know, we do a lot of work just educating communities around the state about what this looks like. Like, what does power look like? And it's not as far away or as far off as you think it is, and that it really is simpler than that. It really is just about being engaged and making sure that your voice gets heard.
Well, I hope your voice is heard.
Me too.
Thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you.
That was Ashley Shelton of the Power Coalition. She's at powercoalition.org. I was delighted to see the leadership that Ashley is bringing to push for positive change in Louisiana. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.